So, Len, who'd you piss off more, HBO or the Iranian Ayatollahs?
The Ayatollahs, I'm proud of it.
Let's start. All right, Len Khodorkovsky, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, awesome. How did a guy like you end up in the State Department?
Certainly not planned. In fact, you know, when I told my parents I was being vetted for the State Department, there was a long pause. You know, we came from the Soviet Union, we're immigrants. And so my parents, I think, started calculating in their head, is the government going to come after us? What does this mean to us? We came from a communist regime. So after a long pause, I think they were actually more proud and happy of me serving my country than I think they were when I told them they were going to be grandparents. So I think it was quite unpredictable, but at the same time, unbelievable opportunity to give back to the country that gave our family a second home. So, you know, how did I get there? We arrived in the United States in the early 80s as refugees, still during the Cold War, during the Soviet Union. And I ended up in the advertising business for my professional career. And that's where I worked for about two decades. The last agency where I worked ended up having a famous client named Donald Trump. When he ran for president, we ended up handling his advertising for the general election of the 2016 campaign. And after he won, he needed people to come to Washington and help transition from the Obama administration to the Trump administration. I raised my hand, I came to DC, I worked in the transition office, worked to get various cabinet nominees through the confirmation process, wrote some articles, produced some videos, greased the skids for the new government to take over. And I was actually proud to bring my parents to the inauguration balls of the swearing in and all that. So that was sweet. And then I went back to advertising.
I'm going to jump in and ask you a question. You know, Donald Trump is one of the most controversial figures ever. You actually got to meet this person, get to know this person. What are some things that most people don't realize about Donald Trump?
I did meet Donald Trump, but both as a candidate and as a president. In my interaction with Donald Trump, and I can't say that I'm, you know, BFFs with Donald Trump. But in my interaction with him, he was nothing but gracious, friendly, thoughtful. So I know that the job is hard, and stories about people losing tempers or coming across as not or being something less than gentlemanly, but you know, that's part of the job. And I'm sure there were some tough moments that would drive anybody up the wall. And if we were on record during every second of our day, I'm sure we wouldn't come across very well either. But in my interactions with him, I actually found him to be thoughtful, smart, strategic, and warm, to be honest with you. Obviously, we're President of the United States is surrounded by cameras and lights 24/7. So there's always an opportunity for bashing any president, but I can't say that I have anything but good things to say about him in my interactions.
All right, cool. So your next gig is in the State Department as a senior advisor?
Yeah, no, I went back to advertising after the transition. And one day somebody that I worked with in the transition gave me a call and said, how would you like to serve your country? And, not something I really planned on, but, gave it about 30 seconds and said yes, and came to the State Department as a digital strategy chief, basically, that handled their digital platforms and broadcast capabilities. You know, got Secretary Pompeo's social media presence going. We redesigned the website. We, you know, we started broadcasting events in real time because we knew we weren't competing with other governments. We were competing with news agencies and people breaking news. And my approach to this was, if we own the news, we should be breaking the news. We should be there first. Our camera should be telling the stories, not somebody else's. So we tried to actually become not just a government operation, but a more relevant information operation. So
let me pause here and ask you a question. You know, I have a hard time managing all of my social media platforms. It takes a long time. I think most Americans don't realize that the United States operates more than a dozen Twitter accounts in dozens of languages, and is on YouTube and on Facebook and so many different platforms. How big is this operation, the State Department social media operation?
It's quite big. And you're not even mentioning the embassies all over the world, which have their own websites and their own social media operations, not to mention the Voice of America or Radio Free Europe or things like that. So there's a constellation of U.S. government and related news or information services all over the place. And I think there's a great opportunity for the U.S. government to harness those tools and be able to convey its message accurately in a way that doesn't get distorted by our adversaries.
But Len, let me ask you a different question. Who runs it? I mean, every embassy runs its own social platforms, and state has its own platforms, but the White House has its own platforms, and so does the DOD and other agencies. Is there a communication officer in chief out there who manages the messaging all across? I mean, because you come from political campaigns, over there you have a campaign manager, you have a communication manager. You know, there is a clear directive every single day about messaging and, you know, talking points and so on. How does it work in such a large bureaucracy called the U.S. government?
Well, I think the template for how it works is not ideal. You know, under normal circumstances, you have a clearance process and a million people have to weigh in on everything, including tweets. So it's very clunky, which a lot of times translates into very diluted, unimpactful messaging. Mm-hmm. However, it all depends on leadership, to be honest with you. So if the Secretary of State or the President, or if you know that people at the top have your back as a professional, then I think you have a little bit more wiggle room in terms of, you know, what you say, how you say it, and you know, and the speed at what you're saying. So I think all of those things are really important. So a lot of times the government messaging operations gets hampered by risk aversion. And that's in my opinion, that is to the detriment of policy. So I think that the most important thing is for everybody under the president and the leadership to understand policy objectives. If there's a clear policy objective, then everybody should know what to do. And if you deviate from that, then you know you're bad. You're not doing a job. If you stay consistent with that, then nobody will take you to task for it.
Len, let's talk about what you did, because you came in there and you disrupted the place. And I'm really curious to know how you actually did it and how you got around the State Department bureaucracy. Because I've spoken to several undersecretaries of public diplomacy who told me that even them, as the head of the game, had to go through clearances, right? So let's talk about you. And let's talk about you and Iran, the maximum pressure campaign. Tell us all about it.
Sure. So after I was still serving as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Digital Strategy when Secretary Pompeo joined the State Department. Remember, he took over from Secretary Tillerson in probably spring of 2018. So he launched something called the Iran Action Group, and that is a small group of folks led by, at the time, Brian Hook, who was the U.S. representative for Iran, that would essentially be the coordinating body for all Iran policy. And, you know, Brian Hook was under control in terms of all things. And, you know, he had policy experts, he had military experts, he had intelligence experts. He did not have a communications expert on the team, which, again, as was my habit, I raised my hand and said, hey, I'll do it. You know, I talked with Brian, and shortly thereafter, he asked me to join the Iran Action Group. So I ended up being the senior advisor for public affairs for the Iran policy for the Trump administration, which, you know, eventually turned into kind of like the chief messaging officer on the maximum pressure campaign.
So let's give a little background. You know, President Obama, you know, engages the Iranians with the Iran deal, very controversial in the Middle East amongst its allies. Then Trump comes in, reverses course, withdraws from the agreement. And now you all have to explain it.
Yeah, that was easy. The deal was actually not very popular in the United States or among our core allies in the region. You know, I'm talking about Israel, the Gulf Arab states, anybody on the front line of the Iranian threat did not like the Iran deal, the JCPOA, as it was called. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't very controversial within, among our allies. And we certainly, you know, President Trump campaigned on this. You know, typically an American president doesn't campaign on foreign policy, but Trump did feature the Iran deal prominently, leaving the Iran deal prominently in his campaign messaging, as he did with China as well. So anybody who was around the Trump campaign understood his position on the Iran deal and on China. So it was not very controversial on the inside. Certainly there were true believers of JCPOA and the quote unquote diplomatic approach to resolving the Iran nuclear threat. But it was clear to many of us that JCPOA did not accomplish that. And so President Trump was actually very true to his campaign promises throughout his administration. And we knew it was just a matter of time before we officially left the deal. Some people are actually even surprised that it wasn't sooner than May of 18.
Right, so we're out of the deal and now it's time to put the pressure on. The sanctions are coming. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. May 2018, President Trump announced that we're gonna leave the deal in about 6 months, which gets us to about November of 2018. We knew this is a big administration emphasis, and we wanted to make sure that the way we leave, the way that we deploy this policy objective is impactful as possible. Obviously, the Iranian regime and many other people were messaging against the United States leaving the deal. The Iranian regime was selling it as, oh, it's gonna hurt regular Iranians. It is damaging to international diplomacy, et cetera. So we wanted to make sure we framed the issue in the way that was consistent with our view of it. And, as we were getting closer, as you can imagine, there are a number of meetings with various people who are part of the policymaking process. We were trying to figure out what's the best way to roll this out. There's always a system of rolling out big policy announcements. You know, there's planning involved, messaging is just part of it. Getting Congress on board, getting our allies on board, all of this is part of the sausage baking on the inside. So my sliver of it was on the messaging side. And during one of the meetings, we were kind of talking about, what should the Iranians think on November 5th of 2018 when the United States leaves the deal? And somebody in the room said, they should think winter is coming, because Game of Thrones was a very big show at the time, and the entire world sort of knew about it, and it clicked something in my mind that, okay, that's exactly right. So how do we convey that? And I My background is in graphic design. I'm an advertising guy. So I quickly whipped up a couple of ideas for Brian Hook. And one of them was, something similar to what ended up coming out, which is a Game of Thrones style poster with the words "sanctions are coming" and November 5th, 2018. And I showed it to him and he loved it. Unbeknownst to me, he sent it to the White House, as a proposal. Didn't hear from the White House for a while until I got a phone call. The day of did you see what President Trump tweeted? And I didn't see it at the time. And I quickly went to his account and there was the poster of the Game of Thrones style poster of announcing sanctions were coming. And of course, President Trump didn't say what sanctions, who were sanctioning. So there was a lot of buzz about that part of it. People in the know, of course, knew that the Iran sanctions were about to be, to be snapped back. But many other people had no idea what this was about. So in a way, I think it helped generate buzz because people started asking, what is this all about? Is this about Game of Thrones? Is this about pop culture? Is this about North Korea? I remember at the time. And so, I just know that that whole weekend leading into the formal announcement, there was a million stories about Trump's tweet. And I should have retired the time, right after that.
But. Yeah, man, high five on that one. But let me see a question, Len. So, in public relations and in public affairs, we always talk about, press conferences and press releases and all that. But, you demonstrated that a meme, can trump, right? It can do much better than those traditional information subsidies. As you think about the media environment that's ever changing, where we need to feed people information like M&Ms, bite-sized, sweet and short, what should foreign affairs people think about when they think about message delivery on social media?
To me, it's all about the same fundamentals that apply in advertising any product. Here we're advertising policy. In the real world, we're advertising some product or service. So I think the first thing you do when you're coming up with any campaign, how do you communicate about any product, which has competitors, which has which has certain market share, and you want to gain market share or achieve some sort of a market benefit, you go back and you ask some fundamental questions. Who are we talking to? What do they want to hear? How do we activate them to do what we're asking them to do? So they're very fundamental issues you need to resolve before you open your mouth. And that was my approach to communicating in government. That's all I knew. I didn't know any better. So I try to apply those same principles as to, how do we ensure that what we want to convey to our audience actually breaks through, the millions of sources of information and all the noise out there. And a lot of times it comes down to simplicity, a message being memorable, something being unique, ownable. I mean, these are all premises of a good advertising campaign, and they still apply. They apply to Iran policy just as they apply to advertising, bubblegum.
Well, it's very interesting because, back in the day, right before 9/11, Secretary of State Colin Powell brought in Charlotte Beers, who was, I believe she was a product manager for Uncle Ben's Rice. And the notion was, let's advertise the United States just like rice. She launched the Shared Values campaign targeting everybody, every single person in the Muslim and Arab world, 1.7 billion people. And I think 2 months later, she was out of the job, $15 million spent. So it's not necessarily that the principles of advertising always work. It's really about knowing who your target audience is, right? And having the deep insights into what's relevant to them at the moment.
That's a big part of it. However, there's not just the a good concept. If you have a great idea, but you can't execute it, then you're not going to have a good campaign. So she may have had a very good strategic idea about what messaging needs to be conveyed to the target audience. But if it's not executed properly, then it falls flat and it's not effective. And I can't say that that's what happened with that. But maybe the timing was wrong. You know, there are any number of things that can throw off a global campaign.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, let's leave it for another day because we have so much more to cover. Len, what's up with you and dictators? You're not a big fan of dictatorships.
Well, I you know, as I said, I grew up in a communist Soviet Union, and I was just, I think it was embedded in me, the suspicion about authority in general, because the Soviet authorities were, you know, anti-Semitic. They were heavy-handed. They stifled individualism and freedoms of all kinds. And when we finally were broke free of that and came to the United States, I, like all immigrants, I suspect, I appreciated the freedom and the opportunities that a democracy afforded me. So, when I entered public service, it was really important to me to share that with everybody that I could share it with and stand for freedom and stand for democracy and advocate for human rights and individual rights. So, to me, that's what America is synonymous with. That's why, you know, every project that I was involved with, I wanted to make sure that the essence of the American brand, which is freedom in one word, came through.
Absolutely. So after Iran, you started going after China. Can you tell us about the Clean Network campaign and what it was all about?
Sure. So my maximum pressure days were essentially from sanctions are coming through the demise of Qasem Soleimani, which was in January of 2020. My lifestyle actually was not great for conducive to family life at the time. So my family was in New Jersey. I was commuting to Washington. I told my wife, I'm just going for a year. And 1 year turned into two and three, et cetera. And it was just very hard to do this with my family being far away. So I told my bosses at the State Department that it was time for me to go home at that point. And lo and behold, you know, the COVID pandemic started becoming a big issue here in the United States and around the world in early 2020. And my boss at the time said, you know what, before you go home, you should speak to this guy. His name was Keith Kroc. He was a former CEO of DocuSign, a former Silicon Valley guy, and he was the Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs at the State Department. And she basically told me to go talk to him before I left Washington. And I did. And his mission was all about securing high tech from China Inc., as he put it. That combined with, dealing with COVID in those early days, pulled me into staying and seeing my government service through. I thought that, you know, the opportunity to work on the China portfolio and help with COVID relief at the time was something that I just could not walk away from. So that's how I ended up working for on the China portfolio. And the biggest issue at the time beyond COVID was high tech and China's march to dominance in high tech, especially in things like 5G. So one of the things that we had to deal with was ensuring that China's appendages of dictatorship, you know, like 5G and like its tools like Huawei and ZTE and various other companies, TikTok these days is in the news. That we pushed them back and ensured that democracy is safe for trusted technology.
So, by the way, I gotta jump in a little more. China was always one of the most controversial topics in the White House under Trump. I mean, from what I learned along the way, there were really two big camps in terms of how much we want to push or engage the Chinese here. How does your work group fit into this wider debate in the White House?
Yes, you're right. There were seemingly two camps, which is, the pro business, but pro, Wall Street more than anything else. And then there was the national security focus group, which I was part of. For a long time, for 30, 40 years, the American policy, as was the policy with all of our friends around the world toward China, was accommodation, trying to give China the benefit of the doubt. The thinking was that if we help China rise through bringing it into our global economic system, that with seeing benefits of being integrated into global economy, it would open up, it would become more tolerant, more democratic. That's not what happened. And, I think COVID actually crystallized a lot of that thinking for a lot of people, because it illustrated the malign nature of the Communist Party and the Xi regime in general. That covered up the origins of COVID, which prevented the entire world to getting to the bottom of it. And still, to this day, we don't know with certainty how things happened. So I think that crystallized how our posture toward China needs to evolve. And Secretary Pompeo, who was my boss on that issue, certainly was very clear about the posture that the United States and our free allies should take toward China's designs for dominance.
Lynn, is there a lesson here? Because we hear it all the time. We hear it with Iran. We heard it with China. We heard it with Russia along the years. And that is, if we can bring in these dictatorships into our free market societies, and if they can enjoy all the benefits of it, then they'll change their ways and become one of us, right? I mean, this is such a typical European or Western perspective. Is there a lesson to be learned here?
I think so. You'd be hard pressed to find an example of a dictatorial regime that reaps the benefits of a free markets and democratic values and respects those things and becomes more open and liberalizes its policies. It hasn't happened. So I think, Americans are optimists. We don't want to go to, our instincts are not to go to the, ultimate tactic of engaging in hardball with anybody. We want to play nice. We want to give people a benefit of the doubt. And I think that comes with having responsibility for being, a powerful economic, military, diplomatic nation. But at the same time, I think we need to be realists and learn the lessons of the past. And those lessons are, they've been taught by, in this case, China, certainly, but which is, you can't drag a dictator across a finish line if they don't want to go. And in the case of China, Xi Jinping doesn't want to go. He does not want to open up. He wants to maintain, tight control over his society and export it to the rest of the world. In Iran's case, certainly, same deal. The regime wanted the benefits of having a deal with the West. It wanted the money. It wanted the legitimacy it attained on the world stage, the diplomatic legitimacy. But at the same time, it actually hardened on the inside. And it continued terrorizing its neighbors and its people. So, I hope we've learned that lesson. And we have to be realistic. As the old Reagan, actually the old Gorbachev adage is trust but verify. Доверяй, но проверяй is in Russian, which means that's fine. We will work with you, but you have to prove that you're working in good faith. And we can implement a plan of steps that build trust and evolve into a mutually beneficial relationship, but it has to be mutually beneficial. It can't be one-sided.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we have so much more to cover. I want to jump to the next topic, which is the Yalla Show. So Yalla, tell me all about it. What is the Yalla Show? You became a TV producer? Asking. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking. So while I was at the State Department, I worked on the Middle East portfolio, through my Iran work. I got a chance to visit a lot of countries in the region. I got to meet a lot of people, and I really came to love the region in general. For me, as a Russian Jew, I really didn't know the Arab world much. I did know Israel, and I did know, that Israel was a democratic country, and it was, for a long time, it was an island in the sea of authoritarianism, but I really didn't know much about its neighbors and neighborhood. So when our Iran-related work took me to the region, I got a chance to meet a lot of people, talk to a lot of people, and what I found out is there's a lot more to the story than the news tells. Even more than diplomats focus on, which is, the relationship between the United States and all the countries in the region is very deep. It actually goes back to the founding of America. And there is actually a lot of love and respect and warmth toward the United States and the region. So I got a chance to get an education about that when I was traveling. And after I left the government service, I wanted to make sure that I kept contributing to the peace that was brought about through the Abraham Accords and subsequent diplomatic engagement. So I wanted to contribute in the way that I knew how, which was through communication and messaging. That's my my talent. And along with an Arab American journalist who I knew from my State Department days, her name is Haiti Buzo, we decided to start a show focused solely on the good news in the Middle East and North Africa region. You don't hear much of that. It's always diluted at the Iranian threat and terrorism and all the things that go wrong in the Middle East. What I came to find out is there are many things that are right in the Middle East. And unlike other Middle Eastern outlets, we wanted to focus on telling the good story of bringing about the success stories, showing people what's possible and what's already being done so that both the people in the region are inspired by stories they hear about people just like them, and people outside the region learn more about what is going on in the realm of not just security cooperation, but in business ties and innovation and healthcare, culture. I mean, it's the most dynamic place on earth, and I wanted to be part of it.
So Len, where does this air? What language? Who is the target audience?
Yeah, Yalla is an Arabic language show. We actually target the next generation of Arabic speaking youth. 18 to 34s is our demographic. Originally, we thought we'd find some audience within the Abraham Accords countries. As it turns out, our audience is across the entire region, even in countries that don't have relationships with Israel, even countries that are not as friendly with the United States. We do have an audience for our message, which is very encouraging. So right now we air on social media channels and digital tech platforms, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at Watch Yalla, WATCHYALLA, Watch Yalla, across all the social channels. And but we are looking for a home in the region. We want to make sure that our unique message is accessible to as wide of an audience as possible in the region.
All right, perfect. Len, seriously, I could talk to you for another 2 hours, but this is becoming the longest episode I've ever recorded. And I'm actually loving this. This is like a Joe Rogan kind of thing.
Thank you.
But let's actually finish up over here with one final question. I think it's going to be an interesting one, controversial one, and I would love to hear your answer on it. Donald Trump's foreign policy legacy. What do you think he's going to be known for the most?
I hope things like Abraham Accords. I hope strengthening our international relationships. And contrary to what you hear, you know, Donald Trump is actually responsible for strengthening NATO, because we actually got NATO to add $140 billion to its defense budget. And we know that as Russia invaded Ukraine, how much NATO is still relevant, and how ensuring a strong defense for like-minded allies around the world is important. And things like Abraham Accords, I think, are a game changer in the Middle East. So I think he also recalibrated America's posture toward China, and that is going to be the foremost challenge for not just the United States, but for democracy for the next generation.
Well, it's definitely a fascinating time in our history, and we'll be watching. Len, thanks so much for coming in today. We really appreciate all of your insights. And thank you all for watching The Public Diplomat. Make sure to subscribe, like, share, do all those wonderful things. For Len and I, have a great day. This is Guy. Thank you.